Syrian rebels fed up with jihadis. Today, Monday, February 10th. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Slipping past the front lines in Syria, we hear from a Syrian reporter who traveled with the rebels, putting his own life on the line.
Fighters were telling me that you have to consider yourself like a member of us. Anything bad will happen to you will happen to us.
He says it's risky, but he wants to help reveal the truth about the war in Syria. Also today, John Kerry's relentless Mideast diplomacy.
The joke in the Middle East is that the Israelis and the Palestinians will agree on a peace deal just to get Mr. Kerry off their back.
And later, a non-Olympic sport involving camels.
This is not camel fight. This is wrestling.
Plus, a global appeal of the Vietnamese show Paris by Night after the news.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What an intractable, violent mess Syria has become in 3 years. Right now, a second round of Syrian peace talks in Geneva is picking up right where the first one dropped off, with each side blaming the other for all the bloodshed. Understanding the conflict in Syria has never been easy, especially not with access for reporters so severely limited and dangerous. But occasionally we are offered a rare glimpse behind the front lines. Syrian journalist Mohammed Ali slipped into his war-torn country from Turkey. His exclusive report for Frontline, our partner program here at WGBH, airs tomorrow on PBS. It's about Ali's time traveling with Free Syrian Army rebels and their battle against the Islamist militant group ISIS outside the strategic town of Al-Atareb.
It was maybe risky to get such, you know, kind of stories out, but for me, it's, you know, helping to reveal the truth. So the fighters, when I was with them, they could take me with them, but it has to be secret. So the fighters were all the time, you know, trying to hide my face. They asked me to put scarf, you know, and things, you know, to let anyone follow me.
So in your report, you travel with these Free Syrian Army rebels as they try to take back this town called Al-Atareb from the ISIS. That would be the rebel movement that you just described. Why is Al-Atareb so important?
The strategy of the ISIS was about, you know, to control the north. And it was kind of junction, you know, it's between Aleppo and Idlib. So if they control it, the rebels in that time will, you know, be under siege because they will lose the whole north. And they will be stuck between the jihadists in the north and the regime forces in the south.
There's a point where we actually see this little film clip that somebody had shot on a cell phone. It's pretty frightening. Let's just hear that, and you can tell us what's going on in it.
It was execution, you know, of seven rebels from the FSA. These guys from some battalion called Ghuraba al-Sham, they were arrested in Aleppo, the city. They were taken from Aleppo to Al-Atareb town, and they were executed by the ISIS fighters. So it was kind of show of strength. Mm. They wanted, you know, to make show of, you know, to send messages that we are strong and we can control the town. And they executed them in front of the eyes of the other, you know, FSA fighters.
Right. And in fact, the rebels you're with decide to launch this raid on one ISIS position. Let's hear a clip of that.
The FSA fighters raided this base and they controlled it and they killed, you know, and arrested some of fighters, ISIS fighters. And the rest of the fighters of ISIS, you know, just ran away.
So what does that say about ISIS? I mean, they seem kind of unable to hold these positions for more than 2 weeks. Can they take over the entire north of Syria? Is that even in the cards?
One of the surprising things, you know, for everyone in Syria, I think, it's not only for the fighters, they were, you know, fearing them, think they are, you know, very strong fighters. But ISIS fighters have no ideology to, you know, fight till the end. They were just, you know, trying to control easy points. They are, you know, not able to have, you know, strong battles.
Yeah, they fled. Are you confident that ultimately the rebels of the Free Syrian Army can defeat the jihadists?
I believe it's going to be a long battle. These guys, the FSA, they don't have enough, you know, ammunition or weapons, you know, to defeat, you know, the jihadists and to fight the regime at the same time. They cannot, you know, fight in two fronts at the same time. They are not a regular army. But there is something promising for the Syrian people that the civilians, you know, were telling them about the location of the jihadists, you know, where they are hiding, you know. It made, you know, their mission easier, you know, than to fight, you know, without support. That's why, you know, you could, you know, believe that they can, you know, defeat them in some way.
Syrian journalist Muhammad Ali, his exclusive report for our partners at Frontline is called Syria's Second Front. It airs tomorrow on PBS stations and at pbs.org. The war in Syria has been just one of the main topics on Secretary of State John Kerry's first-year agenda. The BBC's Kim Gattas covers the State Department, and she's followed Kerry's first 12 months as America's top diplomat.
Mr. Kerry's diplomacy on Syria is limited by what America's allies and foes are willing to do or what they see as the right diplomatic course. You have the Russians who are not willing, for example, to support a resolution at the UN calling on Syria to allow humanitarian aid to enter towns and cities like Homs. You have the Saudis who want the Americans to do more on Syria, including possibly military action. And John Kerry is trying to navigate those competing agendas, keeping also in mind that President Obama himself is very cautious when it comes to dealing with Syria. So I would have to say that John Kerry, as Secretary of State, is probably somewhat frustrated, but doing the best he can and putting a brave face on it.
Now, Russia is a key player in Syria. John Kerry seems to work pretty well with their foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, even chummy at times. Can Kerry get the Russians to lean harder on Assad?
Well, it hasn't worked so far. And if we are to believe reports of a conversation between Mr. Kerry and members of Congress, including people like Senator John McCain, Mr. Kerry is quite frustrated with Sergei Lavrov as well and feels like the Russians aren't delivering and aren't pressing Mr. Assad hard enough. But you have to remember that Russia has its own interests, and it's not because there is a chummy relationship between Mr. Lavrov and Mr. Kerry that Vladimir Putin is going to put what he sees as his national security interests to the side.
Now, John Kerry does get credit for a partial initial breakthrough on Iran, helping to broker the first ever partial freeze of their nuclear program. You go with Kerry pretty much where he goes, Kim. You fly in the same plane. What is he like and what does he believe he can do in countries like Iran that have been our adversaries for several decades?
This is really an incredible moment in U.S.-Iranian relations. For Mr. Kerry, this is a very delicate diplomatic game. He's invested a lot in it. And it plays to his strength, which is the chessboard type of diplomacy, dealing with the big files, the big guys on the international stage, whether it's a deal with the Iranians or whether it's the Middle East peace process. Mr. Kerry is very much about that kind of diplomacy.
Yeah, on the file marked Mideast peace process, Kerry seems almost obsessed with getting some sort of deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians. Do you have any insight, speaking with his aides or with him, on what is motivating that near monomania on Mideast peace?
The joke in the Middle East is that the Israelis and the Palestinians will agree on a peace deal just to get Mr. Kerry off their back because he's so enthusiastic about it. What drives him is what drives every American official who tries their hand at this is the possibility to be remembered in the history books as the one person that brought to an end an intractable conflict that has plagued the region for the last 60 or so decades.
You know, Kim, one of the big things when Kerry went into the job was his connections to foreign leaders, his Rolodex and his ability to get doors open. Ultimately, what are those relationships groomed over decades? What does all that add up to after his first year?
It's a good question. It is something that Hillary Clinton brought to her job as well. The Rolodex, the instant name recognition, the ability to knock on anyone's door and see it open instantly. But that is something that also comes with just being the American Secretary of State. It's something that Condoleezza Rice was able to do as well. There is a certain importance attached to the position of Secretary of State. Mr. Kerry brought a lot of personal connections or connections to world leaders. All of that, of course, helps the initial contact. But at the end of the day, it doesn't necessarily sway the other person if they feel that what is being asked of them is not in their interest. And that is just the reality of diplomacy.
Kim, finally, how's Kerry's beard looking today?
I haven't checked in for a few days, and I must admit that the first time I saw the picture of him with a beard, I almost wonder whether it was photoshopped. So I'm afraid I can't give you an update on his facial grooming habits.
The BBC's Kim Gattis, who covers the State Department. Thanks for your time, and thanks for telling us about John Kerry's first year.
Thanks, Marco. Thanks very much for having me.
Some of the images coming out of Syria in recent days caught our attention. I'm talking about what's happening in Homs, the country's third largest city. It's a city under siege, its citizens trapped inside with virtually no food and services until a tenuous truce allows them to flee. Those scenes look a lot like Bosnia during the war there in the 1990s. Today, Bosnia faces a different dilemma. The nation that emerged from the ashes of the Balkan Wars now faces massive unemployment and government corruption and big protests. Elvira Jukic is a reporter with the online news outlet Balkan Insight in Sarajevo.
Everything started on Wednesday, actually, in Tuzla, where workers started complaining. I mean, they had been complaining for months about these companies that they used to work in, which were privatized, and then they were ripped off and they were closed after privatization. And then kind of in support to Tuzla, many people started gathering in Sarajevo and other towns. So on Friday, the situation escalated, and when there were news in the media that the building of government in Tuzla was set on fire, the same happened in Sarajevo in a matter of minutes. From time to time, there had been some fights between the protesters and the police. I was there the whole time, and I could see two or three police cars being on fire, and everything was...
I mean, as you say, it sounds really messy. It sounds chaotic. Yeah. But you were in these protests on Friday. I gather it took several rounds of back and forth of aggression between protesters and police before you started getting a sense of what these protests are all about. So what are they all about?
People are angry. And when I talked to people in the streets, with the protesters, everybody said, we have had enough of this type of government, this way of being in power.
And what does that mean? What type of government? What are they doing that people are so angry about?
Reluctant and incompetent politicians. One of the largest problem is corruption. And also, when I say corruption, it's not just that some politicians are taking money from some public procurements and whatever, but politicians in a way that you cannot get a job after you finish university. You have to have somebody who is a friend or family to get a proper job.
Right, so kind of nepotism. So how much of this trouble, nepotism, corruption, unemployment, how much of it can you trace back to the war in the 1990s in the Balkans?
This looks like anger of the people was being accumulated over the years, because after the war was over in 1995, there were several years of reconstruction. And after that period, people expected something new and something which would bring them, basic elements of a normal life. And that didn't happen. So it all led to this moment when thousands who lost their jobs, who don't have an opportunity to work and earn for a living, have decided to go out the streets and say, we've had enough.
Elvira Jukic, a reporter with the online news group Balkan Insight, speaking with us from Sarajevo. Thank you very much.
Thank you too, Marco.
Still ahead on the world, the Motorcycle Girl Gangs of Morocco on PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at medtronicphilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. As every school kid knows, Switzerland is a neutral country. Its image basically is, plays well with everybody. But over the weekend, Swiss voters sent a different message. They narrowly approved a system of immigration quotas. That's upset the European Union, whose members surround Switzerland, which is a non-member. And critics say the vote signals a growing Swiss intolerance toward immigrants. The BBC's Imogen Fuchs is in Bern, the capital of Switzerland. What drove Swiss voters, do you think, to limit immigration?
Basically, not economic reasons. This is a very comfortably off country, high standard of living, very little unemployment. But since Switzerland opened its borders to the European Union, immigration has increased. There's no two ways about that. There's no arguing about the statistics. The Swiss had expected about 8,000 new people every year with opening their borders to the EU. Instead, they're getting around 80,000. Now, it's true that there is a market for highly skilled people in Switzerland and also for non-skilled doing jobs the Swiss themselves don't like to do anymore. Mm. But it has made at least half of yesterday's voters anyway feel uncomfortable that their country is maybe changing too fast, that the country is too crowded, that there's pressure on schools and hospitals, on public transport, things like that.
So how would these quotas work, Imogen? Who are they aimed at specifically?
Well, this is a very, very tricky question. The government is now in the very difficult position of having to work this out, because what the proposal that went before voters said was introduce quotas, renegotiate free movement of people. But it doesn't put a figure on the quotas. It doesn't suggest nationalities or professions that would be hardest hit or preferred. However, it will apply to EU citizens. Now, at the moment, they are really able to come here and work freely. That will no longer be the case. But in terms of figures, we are not sure yet how it's going to work. What is absolutely clear, however, is that Swiss business leaders are very dismayed. They want to be able to recruit European workers. Many young people in Switzerland are dismayed because they want to be able to go to Europe and work freely. They may no longer be able to do so. And the Swiss government is working out how it's going to explain to Brussels that it has opted out of a very fundamental part of policy, which may affect its other crucial trade ties with Europe.
Are we talking also skin color here? I mean, are Swiss more worried about Algerians who are living in France who might come to Switzerland more than they are about, you know, white French?
Maybe some of them are. I think it would be foolish to say that they're not. But, you know, you can have xenophobia, racism, if you like. It's not necessarily determined by skin color. I can give you a rather amusing example is that although the majority of Swiss live in the German-speaking region and speak German, they speak a very, very different kind of German as the Germans. And when free movement came into force here, a great many Germans came across the border to work in Switzerland's hospitals, for example, where we have a shortage of doctors here in Switzerland. And the Swiss were very uncomfortable with it. And there was a very strong anti-German sentiment. Mm. And that is still there. The biggest influx is from Germany, and there is a discomfort.
So is there any turning back? Does the EU have any ability to appeal to a non-member like Switzerland?
I think there will be negotiations behind closed doors, but there's no turning back because of Switzerland's system of direct democracy. The people have voted for it, and the government will now have to implement it. And they've got a lot of thinking to do now, the government members, because they know that immigration is an issue in Switzerland which will have to be addressed. But not only that, but because of the narrowness of this vote, they have a very divided country. That's not good for a small country. And I know, having been out and about in the capital in Bern today, that is causing a lot of worry.
The BBC's Imogen Fuchs in Bern, Switzerland, telling us about the new immigration restrictions that Swiss voters narrowly approved this weekend. Thanks for your time.
Thanks.
In Europe, as here in the U.S., crash tests are conducted to judge the relative safety of cars. And much of that research is done using crash test dummies. But one testing center in Spain is about to start doing something American researchers have long done, testing cars and safety equipment using human cadavers. They apparently give better data than inanimate dummies, though they're not perfect either. The World's Jerry Hannon reports from Albañiz in Spain.
In a warehouse on an arid plateau in the country's northeast, a group of engineers operate what amounts to a giant slingshot. When released, a car simulator catapults forward, then stops abruptly like someone stomped on the brakes. Today's crashes are part of a battery of tests on a new infant car seat at a public research center called TESA. Strapped into it is an infant dummy. Lead engineer Francisco López Valdés says the world owes crash test dummies a lot. They're amazing instruments, he says. There are four or five sensors embedded in each one. They let us measure 150 different values every tenth of a millisecond, including force, resistance, deceleration, skeletal movement. And yet, he says, researchers know dummies don't perfectly simulate human beings. So while he will learn a lot from today's dummy, soon, he says, his data will vastly improve. To explain, he takes me into a brightly lit room right next to the test track. It's TESA's brand new morgue. Complete with freezers where they'll soon be storing human cadavers, donated to science. So what new data will cadavers bring to car safety? Mainly whether a new safety product, say a seatbelt or a car seat, will protect you from soft tissue injuries. López Valdés knows from experience. He worked at a similar lab in Virginia. He says the research there saved lives.
Con un fabricante estuvimos ensayando unos sistemas de protección.
We were testing a new safety belt once, he says, and with the dummies we got incredible results. But when we did the follow-up tests with cadavers, he says, we realized that there was a dangerous flaw in the design. The belt protected the thorax, but not the pelvis. You couldn't see this with the dummies, since obviously they don't have working parts in those areas. As a result, López Valdés says the manufacturer fixed the flaw before going to market.
Well, it's not an easy job to build a perfect dummy because the perfect dummy is you and me.
Albert King is a distinguished professor of biomedical engineering at Wayne State, where testing with cadavers all began in 1939. King agrees that cadaver testing has saved countless lives, but even testing with them isn't perfect. There are technical challenges. For example, cadavers can't hold themselves up. King says the U.S. has led Europe on safety tests with cadavers, in part because of red tape within the European Union. But Europe has just approved new guidelines. As for where López Valdés cadavers will come from, he says he isn't worried. Spain has the highest organ donor rate in the world. Just yesterday, someone called who'd lost a family member in a road accident, he says. This person wants to donate his own body to prevent further tragedies. Then there's a retired government official who worked in road safety his whole life. He said he wants this to be the natural, logical finale to his career. Both López Valdés and Dr. King stressed that researchers treat cadavers with respect, and they remain anonymous. The biggest challenge, getting child cadavers to test seats like the one here at TESA today. Parents, they say, are understandably reluctant to donate an infant's body for this research. For The World, I'm Sherry Haddon, outside Zaragoza, Spain.
This is PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Marco Werman. Ahead, Paris by Night is a popular variety show among Vietnamese expats. Older ones, anyway.
When I was growing up, I did watch Paris by Night. I literally was like, that's so corny. That's so stupid. Like, why would you do that?
But now this young Vietnamese-American is helping to update the show. Plus, the motorcycle girl gangs of Morocco. Yeah, really.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Medtronic Philanthropy, expanding access to chronic disease care for the underserved by supporting organizations in communities where they live and work, such as Washington, D.C.-based Unity Healthcare. You can learn more at MedtronicPhilanthropy.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World, a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH Boston. The proper treatment of animals is a topic that can generate some very heated arguments among us humans. You don't have to tell that to the people of Denmark after what went down at the Copenhagen Zoo over the weekend. You've probably seen the stories. A healthy giraffe there was killed by officials, and its remains were then literally fed to the lions. The zoo even invited visitors, including children, to watch the animal's autopsy and later the feeding. Now, this isn't some bizarre sidebar. It's been the top story in Denmark for the past several days. Kim Biltzo-Lassen is a news anchor on Denmark's DR1 TV channel. He explains why zoo officials decided to kill Marius the giraffe.
Well, it was killed because it was basically a part of a program where you breathe giraffes, and there was no room for it, simply. I mean, there are too many giraffes, and it couldn't be transferred to another zoo because of the genetics within this specific group of giraffes. So they've said that this was the best way to deal with this problem, and they've also underlined that they would do it again if it came to the same situation.
So how long has this saga been debated by people in Copenhagen? Because I've heard, like, right up to the last minute, people were protesting outside the zoo as if they were asking the governor for a stay of execution.
There were only a few people. I think there were 15 people standing outside the zoo when it opened. But there has been a debate. It's been on social media and so forth.
I mean, trying to keep the breed of giraffes from inbreeding is understandable, but I think a lot of people are bothered by why carve up this beast once it's been shot in front of bystanders and then feed the body parts to the lions. What have they said about that at the zoo?
They said this was an educational thing, that you might as well, you know, show people how this is done, how a giraffe is, you know, what it looks like inside, and also that the most natural thing was to not destroy the meat, but to give it to lions or other predators who would eat this in the wild.
I mean, visitors to the zoo in that video, they do seem curious and are there to learn. Where have you been hearing the biggest criticism?
From abroad.
From abroad?
And also there's been on social media, I think quite a few people at one point thought it was just a gimmick, which it certainly isn't, as far as I've understood. And then there has been sort of small groups of animal lovers, I don't know if that's the right term to use here, but people who are protesting this because it's a giraffe and it seems inhumane, where the zoo and the director there have said, this is part of the program that we run, and it is not different because it's a giraffe that has big brown eyes or whether it's a small animal. We have to deal with it the same way.
And people in Denmark, you think, are more in sync with the zoo officials, and this is just part of the way things go in life?
We haven't made a public survey about it, but I think there was a big uproar in the beginning. And then I think when the zoo explained what was actually the purpose of it and why it was done, I think most people understood that this was, as you say, part of life.
Kim Biltzow-Lassen with Denmark's National TV News. Thank you very much.
You are most welcome.
For our next story, I've got four words for you. Moroccan motorcycle girl gang. That's what you see in a series of photographs by Moroccan photographer Hassan Hajjaj. Women wearing veils and traditional clothes posing on their bikes. Hajjaj has an exhibit of his work called Kesh Angels in New York right now. Kesh is short for Marrakesh. And Hajjaj told me about one angel in particular, a woman named Karima.
She's a girl that works in Jemaa, which is the square in Marrakesh where all the tourists come, and the Moroccans, they have, it's like a theatre. You got snake charmers, monkeys, storytellers. And she's a third generation doing henna for the tourists and Moroccans. And I was really attracted to her because she wears a veil and she wears these really amazing textile jellabas. You know, the things we wear with the hoods, the long gowns with the hood, and also rides a bike to work and back. She's a normal woman that works probably like 8-10 hours a day in the square. She speaks about 4 or 5 languages. She's, you know, housewife, 2 kids, built her own house over the years. So really, that started from there as an influence back in the 90s. And then I started to ask other friends to pose. And then later on, as I was using my design, I kind of added that in some of the images.
What about their motorcycles? Are they really motorcycles, more like scooters? Are they obsessed about them?
Yeah, I mean, depends what shoots, because there is some bikes that have, you know, was my friend and they posed on it, but I would say most of the bikes, it's their bikes.
Right.
The thing is, I've only highlighted, you know, the girls on bikes, but you have to remember Marrakesh is really a bike city, you know, it's a mobilette city,
right.
And everybody rides them, from a young kid, a man, the younger, older, and you can see all, it's a feast for the eye. You're going to see things you're going to laugh at. You can see like a woman riding with a sheep behind them, and the husband behind that. You're going to see 2 guys carrying a big piece of glass between them. I mean, it's transport. It's, you know, used for work. It's used to get by. It's not somebody who's going to be, you know, putting rims on them and stuff like that.
How did you become interested in photography in the first place?
Well, I was born in Morocco, and then I came to England in 73, and I've become a misfit because I didn't speak English and stuff. But from the age of, let's say, you know, born until 13, I can say I probably have 3 pictures of myself that were taken in the studios. So my first experience would be, because my dad was living in England in 66, and I was still living in Morocco with my mum, my aunt and my sisters. So every few years we'd dress up and we'd go to a local studio and there'd be a different backdrop or something like that, and they would take a picture, and then you go a few days later to collect the picture to be able to send to my father in London. So that was my first, I would say, impact photography. I remember, and I would never forget, going to that room, seeing the lights, the film, the backdrops. And then every time we go downtown, we look at the pictures at the front, because we'll have the pictures of people that he's taken with and the front of the shop. So we go down and see if we know anybody. We grew up watching Indian movies. So if you go down, if you can't get in to see the movie, you go and see the pictures outside the movie and you fantasize. So that was my first thing, I suppose, with photography.
Now, we recently featured a photographer who was in Marrakesh and found it really hard to take pictures of subjects there. People just didn't want their pictures taken. What about you? What was your experience like? Because, I mean, some of these women just are badass. They say, seem to be saying, go on, take pictures of me any which way you want.
I mean, for me, it was really about trust. It wasn't something that I just met the person and said, let's shoot. It was time, you know, and they got to understand what I do. So now they ask me when I'm shooting, when is the next shoot going to be with them? Mm. So it really takes time. It's trust, and also, you know, in Morocco, especially the older generation, it's like, you know, they have this thing. Probably in Africa, if you take a picture of them, it's like you're taking their soul.
Right.
So you have this element of it as well.
Yeah, it's almost like understanding the code and obeying that code. How do people in Morocco see your art? Do they see it as, oh, this is Hassan and a bunch of his friends, or do they see it as art?
No, I think it's been accepted as art. No, I mean, I've been very lucky. I've got a big support in Morocco, especially the younger generation and the age of the internet. There was one point I felt lonely on my own because, you know, being Moroccan, doing what's so-called, I suppose, Arab art, it was a bit of a lonely space because, you know, in the West, nobody's going to take you serious because you'd be that kind of ethnic Arab, Moroccan, North African artist. Mm-hmm. So you're not going to be getting to the white cube or anything like that. And this is before. So I think, you know, it was just a mixture, I suppose.
Well, you certainly don't want to miss Hassan Hajjaj's pictures of the Kesh Angels. We have some of them on our website, PRI.org. Hassan Hajjaj, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, sir.
Camels and wrestling. I never thought I'd say those two words in the same sentence. Now, you won't see this in Marrakesh, probably, not yet anyway, but camel wrestling is a thing in Turkey, where the animals are trained to square off in bouts of strength and skill. Reporter Jacob Resnick took in a match in the town of Seljuk.
Camels are tall, lumbering creatures. You don't want to get in their way. They can move surprisingly quickly, especially when two are locking necks, almost like a double helix, trying to overpower each other. Turkey's largest camel wrestling tournament is held annually here in Seljuk, a market town of about 20,000 people. Camels are naturally pretty docile creatures, but get more aggressive during mating season, so that's when the competitions are held. Female camels aren't welcome at the events. If they were here, things might get really serious. With about 130 male camels and tens of thousands of drunken spectators, these camels are riled up enough. Ahmet Sarsamaz has been training camels for 15 years. He says they're intelligent, sensitive creatures. But he said when things get tense, camels get aggressive. And then they're ready to wrestle. Camels have long been critical to the economic development of this area. They carried crops like olives and figs to nearby seaports. When the railroads came about 150 years ago, camels had less practical use, so people who were fond of raising them had to find other reasons to keep them. Gökhan Sercelik is a local attorney who grew up here and has been coming to camel bouts since he was about 6. He says many people here revere camels almost like sports heroes.
I've seen lots of people when their favorite camel was beaten, they were crying. You know, it's not about gambling, it's about love.
The rules are simple. There's no point system. If a camel is forced to his knees, he loses. If a camel runs away, the braver camel wins. Or if a camel cries out in fright, that also ends the match. Animal welfare groups have complained about this sport, but there's no organized opposition. I contacted a few animal rights activists in Turkey, but none got back to me. Ahmed Soyuchu, used to help organize these events. He argues camel wrestling is not inhumane or a blood sport, just a way to prove which camel is stronger.
They try to prove their power to each other or one to another, so they don't hurt each other. If you see, their mouths are covered. They have no chance to bite. This is not camel fight. This is wrestling.
For wealthy locals, owning a camel can be the ultimate status symbol. It costs around $10,000 a year to keep one, and there's no cash prize for winning an event. Soyuchu says owning a wrestling camel is all about prestige and bragging rights.
Like, my camel is stronger than your camel. My camel look more beautiful than your camel. It is like a social competition.
It's also an excuse to throw a big party. There were probably 20,000 people at this event. Booze vendors are doing a roaring trade, selling liquor by the bottle. Groups of men, and it's mostly men here, sit together on long tables grilling meats and toasting each other with raka, Turkey's most cherished hard alcohol. Most of the men are Muslim, by the way, and the Quran forbids alcohol, but drink is still an integral part of Turkish culture. Ahmed Soyuchu said men from this region enjoy traveling the camel wrestling circuit. It gives them a chance to get out of their hometowns and cut loose.
They see it like an opportunity to go out of the society, do whatever they want. For example, they drink all day and night long. They get drunk because nobody knows them. So nobody will say that you are bad, you are this, you are that. So when they return to their small society, they are still good father, good man, good friend. It's like that.
There's also a lot of meat being grilled here. Camel meat. Tourists like Robert Lloyd, a Londoner who teaches English in Istanbul, was keen to try it.
I was so excited about it, I ate some, and it's delicious. It's really good. It tastes like camel smell, which is kind of off-putting, but they spice it really well, so it's good. I'm a fan.
He bought a few extra pounds to take home with him as well. Besides the wrestling and the drinking and the eating, there's also a bit of pageantry and music. Those aren't kazoos. Bands of mostly Roma musicians entertain the crowds. People stuff cash in their clarinets as tips. The day before the wrestling match, there was also a beauty contest for camels dressed in their best finery. For The World, I'm Jacob Resnick in Seljuk, Turkey.
The sound of the neigh, Turkey's traditional answer to the clarinet. Very mosquito-like, don't you think? So how about a little dose of Turkish fuzz rock before the break? This tune is from a CD reissue of psychedelic Turkish rocker Alpe. Big in the early 70s in Turkey, lots of wah-wah guitar and distortion over traditional Turkish instruments and time signatures. Check out Alpe's 1973 track called Yekte. Başım koyup uzansaydım dizine, ben ölsem de gönlüm sendedir güzel. Yekte, yekte yavrum yekte, bastırmalar denkte, kızlar oynamakta, ne olursa olsun delikanlılıkta.
Yekte, yekte yavrum yekte, bastırmalar denkte, kızlar oynamakta, ne olursa olsun delikanlılıkta.
Turkish fuzz rocker Alpe there. He's still alive, living in Ankara, where today he's a painter. This is PRI, Public Radio International.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from Lumosity.com, a brain training program designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 50 million people worldwide. More at Lumosity.com.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. It's raining in Britain. Whoa, stop the presses. No, actually stop the sarcasm. Even among Brits long used to wet and dreary winters, the rain this winter is off the charts. The UK just suffered through its wettest January on record, and forecasters say there's no end in sight. The rain has brought severe flooding to parts of southern England and widespread finger-pointing about bungled flood management. Now it's brought something else, a warning from the country's top climate scientists that climate change is likely to deliver more nasty weather. Here's The World's environment editor, Peter Thompson.
When British Prime Minister David Cameron speculated a month ago that climate change was probably playing a role in the storms that were lashing his country this winter, his government's own climate agency wasn't ready to back him up. At the time, the Met Office, as the agency is known, said tying the rains and floods to climate change was a research project which hasn't been done. Well, a month later, some of that research is starting to come in, and the Met Office suggests Cameron was right. Dame Julia Slingo is the agency's chief scientist.
And there are now some studies emerging that suggest that storminess is increasing if we look at the long-term trends over the last century or so.
Slingo says that taken by themselves, there's been nothing unusual about any of the individual storms that have struck the UK this winter, but that their clustering and persistence have been extremely unusual. In other words, one or even a few of these storms would be perfectly ordinary for Britain, but one after another is pretty much unprecedented. Slingo says there's been nothing like it since the British began keeping records in the 1760s, almost 250 years ago. The rains have flooded more than 5,000 homes and cut off rail links to much of the country's southwest, and there's now rising concern about rising waters heading east along the Thames River toward London. The flooding has brought a wave of recrimination against government agencies for not responding better to the crisis or being better prepared in the first place, and Prime Minister Cameron has had to make assurances that his government is on top of the situation.
Whether it is helping people get out of their homes, whether it's help protecting essential infrastructure, whether in the case yesterday it's a question of moving cattle off the land, we'll do everything we can to help coordinate what is still a very difficult situation.
Of course, Britain isn't alone in facing a barrage of unusual weather this winter, and the Met Office says there's almost certainly a connection between the waves of Arctic cold blasting much of the United States and the waves of storms hitting the UK. The agency says both are linked to unusual disruptions in the jet stream over the Pacific and North America. In another acknowledgement that more flooding like this winter's almost certainly lies ahead, Britain is now seeking advice on flood control from the Netherlands and the United States, two countries that have faced their own challenges with high water. For The World, I'm Peter Thompson.
When you hear Paris by Night, you might think moonlight walks along the Seine. But for most Vietnamese outside Vietnam, they know Paris by Night as the name of a very popular Vietnamese variety show. The live shows regularly sell out. Josie Huang of KPCC tells us how Paris by Night became such a fixture for Vietnamese living outside their homeland.
Imagine you're at a Vegas-style show. There's glitz, music, it's iconic, and entirely in Vietnamese. The show is part slapstick and part song and dance with big flashy numbers, along with traditional Vietnamese ballads. It's called Paris by Night, and it's a hit wherever it travels. Vegas, Toronto, Southern California. Crystal Lynn Lee was at a venue an hour outside San Diego, ecstatic about seeing her favorite stars.
I like Ting and I like Martin Van. I love that singer. I love the voice.
Thousands filled the venue that day, all there for a four-hour-long show. People can't get enough. The show's been around for more than 30 years, created by a Vietnamese producer in Paris for other expats who'd fled the Vietnam War and missed home. Later, the producer moved the show to Southern California, where Vietnamese Hollywood catered to a growing diaspora.
Vietnamese Americans celebrate by getting together, maybe eating Vietnamese food, and then popping in a Paris by Night DVD.
Lan Xun teaches media and cultural studies at the University of California, Riverside.
We come together to laugh, to talk about, the singing, how bad it is, how good it is, how beautiful some of the singers are.
Paris by Night also lets older Vietnamese immigrants share history with younger generations. Its songs are about Vietnam before the war, before communists took over. You'll find DVDs of the show in Vietnamese homes throughout the world, in the U.S., Canada, Europe, Australia. But in Vietnam, Paris by Night DVDs are banned because some of its content criticizes communist rule, so...
All the copies in Vietnam are bootleg or through illegal downloads.
John Nguyen is production coordinator for Paris by Night.
Even like the American industry is being hurt by bootleg. We're so much smaller. It's been tough.
That's not the show's only challenge. Its audience is mostly middle-aged or elderly immigrants. It needs new fans to keep surviving. And Justin Nguyen knows this challenge well.
When I was growing up, I did watch Paris by Night. I literally was like, that's so corny. That's so stupid. Like, why would you do that?
He's young, Vietnamese, came to California as a kid, and now he's one of Paris by Night's newest talents. That's Justin helping to open the Paris by Night show in Southern California. He's there to attract younger fans with his hip-hop dance moves and music with a beat.
It's a dream come true, but I still got to pinch myself because I'm like, is this really happening?
As important as it is for Paris by Night to get new fans, it's not ready to give up its roots. And that's where Tian Tong comes in. Tong is practicing before getting on stage. At 29, he's one of the new kids, too. But he prefers the old standards.
I'm kind of like an old soul, you know, for a young person. But even like American music, I tend to like the older stuff, like American jazz standards, Frank Sinatra, and stuff like that.
Production manager John Nguyen has included Tong in the last five Paris by Night DVDs.
He sings the music of the older generation, and he sings it very well. We need people like that to continue the tradition.
And for Tong, that's a privilege. On stage, Tong sings the part of a homesick man abroad. Longtime Paris by Night fans know the song well. Now Tong hopes to introduce it to his generation. For The World, I'm Josie Huang, Los Angeles.
To see a trailer for the DVD of Paris by Night, go to our website, PRI.org. You can also find photos from the show, think Vietnam meets vaudeville. Again, that's at PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for listening.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH, supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks, by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues, by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems, at skoll.org. The Luce Foundation's Henry R. Luce Initiative on Religion and International Affairs, by the PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors to the trust include Peter and Catherine Darrow, the Tagney Jones Family Fund, and the Rose Family Fund, and by the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael and Ann Cerisi.
PRI, Public Radio International.